Okay, good evening, everyone. And thank you so much for joining us for this, which is the second talk in our seminar series on race, religion, and difference in the 19th century. I'm Tom Sammers. I'm a cultural historian at the University of Durham, and I'm a member of the Centre for 19th Century Studies in the Northeast. I'm also one of the co-organisers of this series, along with David Feldman from the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Antisemitism and Ella Zelzanis from the University of Newcastle. The aim of our interdisciplinary seminar this year is to explore how multiple discourses on race and religion intersected in the global 19th century. Last time we had a paper from Dorian Bell looking at antisemitism in France, and tonight I am delighted to say we'll be thinking about the representation of Islam. So our speaker tonight is Kate Nichols, who is an art historian of Britain and the British Empire, who is working primarily on that long 19th century. Since 2018, Kate has been the Birmingham Fellow in British Art in the Department of Art History, Curating and Visual Studies at the University of Birmingham. She's currently working on a book project, which is provisionally titled A Global History of Victorian Art. And Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery is actually one of the case study collections in this project. And so Kate has told me that today's paper grows out of a bigger attempt to rethink local museum histories within broader contexts. So her full title tonight is The Civic Gospel and Images of Islam: Race, Religion, and Difference on display at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, circa 1885. Kate is going to speak to us for somewhere between 30, 35 minutes, something like that. And then I will open it up for about half an hour of questions. If you have a question, you can either raise your hand using the function at the bottom of the screen or just type the word question into chat. And that way I'll know that you'll like to speak and I will ask you to unmute. With that out of the way, Kate, let me just say a huge thank you and say how grateful we are that you've agreed to talk to us tonight. Your work really fits perfectly with a lot of the broader interests of this seminar group. So thank you for making time to talk to us, and over to you.
Oh, well, thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to hearing questions as well. I'm just going to faff around and attempt to share my screen. Okay, all working all right? Yeah, excellent. Brilliant. Well, I shall make a start. And thank you so much, everyone, for coming. It's lovely to see some friends in the audience I haven't seen for a long time as well. So I look forward to talking more afterwards. Okay. So in 2016, responding to consultations with religious communities across the city, Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery is a mouthful, and from now on I'll be calling it BMAG, which is what it's known as locally, opened its Faith in Birmingham Gallery, assembled from the museum's permanent collection and co-curated with a wide range of local people of faith. The focus of this paper is one of the key objects in the spiritual life section. William Mueller's 1843 painting, Prayers in the Desert, is one which might easily be written off as a dubious Victorian Orientalist caricature. Yet, it was an image which Muslim co-curators of the exhibition, one of whom is seen shown here on the slide, were keen to include for all its inaccuracies to emphasize the centrality of prayer to Muslim life. The museum's current display, which situates Mueller's painting in an emphatically religious context, foregrounds the ongoing conversations about the representation and practice of Islam, which have been generated by and around this painting. So you can just see here's the spiritual life section, and the painting is just poking around the corner with its fabulous gold frame there. Prayers in the Desert is widely referred to as the first British painting to show Muslims at prayer, and it was undoubtedly one of the earliest to do so. And in my first section of the talk here, I'll use Mueller's painting to explore the role played by visual culture in understandings of Islam in Victorian Britain. I then examine this broader vision of religious diversity in the context of internal pluralism within Victorian Christianity, examining its display in Birmingham's Nonconformist-led art gallery from 1885 onwards. The late 19th century innovation of public civic art galleries and museums in regional towns and cities became a new and significant context for the display and mass viewing of images. But the religious valences of these settings remain underexplored. Indeed, they're often seen as secular spaces and alternatives to places of worship. I want to ask what the viewing conditions of this example, the painting by Müller, and its relationships with the paintings displayed alongside it might reveal about religious diversity, race, and difference in 19th century Birmingham, where images of Muslims, Jews, Catholics, Lutherans, and Unitarians jostled for attention in a major civic space. So, prayers in the desert and Victorian visions of Islam. Prayers in the Desert focuses on seven men in the process of prayer. To their right are the remains of an ancient Egyptian temple, which might serve as decoration and to provide something of a border to the landscape behind them, but which might also be read, in common with many Orientalist visions of Egypt, as a sign of the belatedness and out of time so-called nature of contemporary Egypt, its connection with ruination and decay. Behind the men, we can see a tent camp, two camels, and another three smaller figures of men to the left. And the entire painting is bordered by a mountain range. A dark sky, thick with paint, swirls above them. Prayers in the Desert stands apart from better known 19th century Orientalist images, two shown on the screen here, in both content and form. So these are both French works. In general, British Orientalist painting was less fixated on overtly sexualized scenes of the harem or slave markets, like its French counterparts. Most celebrated are David Roberts's vast and monumental landscapes, like this one on the screen here, and John Frederick Lewis's minutely detailed paintings focusing on life in Egypt, the product of his 10-year residency in Cairo. And other famous visions within Victorian painting of the Orient are include William Holman Hunt's Pre-Raphaelite detailed visions, which are usually, like this one, laden with Christian typology. Images of Muslims at prayer are notably rare in these Orientalist paintings, for all their claims to detailed anthropological rendering. And I'll just kind of scroll through a few on the screen here. But all of these, of course, post-date Müller's by quite a long time. All focus primarily on men at prayer in mosques, enabling a detailed rendering of architectural features, as well as a focus on religious practice. Apart from Lewis's rather exceptional and intriguing image, which appears to be a self-portrait, taking Orientalist fancy dress a step further than the norm, none of these images focus on detailed individuals as Müller does, nor on an emotional internal religious life. Further, these paintings' emphasis on prayer as a communal and even mass masculine experience sets them distinctly apart from contemporary images of Christian prayer, which focus almost entirely on women and children and are usually in domestic settings. As all these examples testify, the form of British Orientalist painting in the 19th century at least tended towards precision and detail and away from the broad brushstrokes and thickly laid on paint that Müller favoured. However, Prayers in the Desert carries nonetheless a number of very carefully rendered details, as shown on the screen here, in its anthropological interest in religious practice and its attention to details of clothing. Bowed figure dressed in white even has dirt under his finger and toenails. This is a painting that quite adamantly asserts its basis in lived experience, its sandblasted camel trekking credentials. Muller had visited Egypt in 1838-9, one of the earliest professional British painters to do so. He wrote accounts of his travels for the London Art Press. And like most British Orientalist artists, well, most Orientalist artists in general, emphasized the authenticity that his Egyptian experiences brought to his painting. And the press bought it. For example, when this painting was exhibited in 1843, the Athenaeum noted that, I quote, "Mr. Muller has evidently lived amid the scenes and personages he represents." However, Prayers in the Desert was painted in a London studio 4 years after Muller returned from Egypt. That rolling, evocative sky thick with paint is, as Muller discussed, based on images by 17th century landscape painter Claude Lorraine. According to Muller's biographer, the men are London models dressed in clothes he had bought back from his travels. I've pored over Muller's travel sketchbooks in the British Museum, which are shown here on the screen, and found no sketches of Muslims at prayer. I found some Egyptian temples, but no images of people praying, nor any sketches of people which significantly match any of the men in the painting. Muller might have relished what he described as a, quote, "humanity put into a kaleidoscope, such as its endless variety," that he saw present in Egypt. But he was clearly able to recreate that swirling, colourful visual thrill back in 1840s London. The dirt under these men's fingernails is urban grime rather than grains of sand. The ethnic diversity encapsulated in the painting is testimony not to the artist as traveller, but as armchair anthropologist, and to the religious and ethnic diversity of 1840s London. It's quite possible that these men were members of the resident 1840s population of Lascars, natives of East India Company administered territories who sailed in the company sailing ships. And there were reported 3,000 men a year sailing to and staying in London alone. Further, despite Muller's authenticity claims, the men's poses seem to have simply been lifted from Edward Lane's 1836 Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians. Lane's broadly sympathetic, overwhelmingly detailed rendering of religious practice in Cairo and was one of the key sources of knowledge of Islam in early 19th century Britain. Muller's use of it as a point of departure for this landmark oil painting both affirms Lane's credentials and his own, creating a vision of Islam mediated entirely through other British visual representations. Lane's didactic text sought to provide images of each stage of prayer, and Muller reproduces this, creating a vision of non-unified prayer, which many Muslim visitors to BMAG today have noticed and questioned. The painting seems to have made very little impression at all on contemporary reviewers. Some criticized and some praised the drawing of what they called the figures. One noted its rich tone of colour, but perhaps surprisingly, its subject matter seems to have been almost entirely ignored. The two reviews I've managed to find that actually explore its content note only, I quote, the earnestness of devotion of its protagonists and their racial diversity. So there's no kind of interest or no one really remarks that this is the first painting to depict such subject matter. And perhaps we can kind of explore some of the reasons for that in the Q&A session. Nonetheless, a significant number of people throughout Britain had access to prayers in the desert. In addition to the around 70,000 visitors to the Royal Academy that would have seen it on the walls that year, it was engraved in 1847 for the Art Union, which had a monthly circulation of 14,000 people. It was shown at the 1857 Manchester Art Treasures Exhibition, which attracted some 1.3 million visitors. In its first 10 years at Birmingham, the painting could have been viewed by the gallery's phenomenal average of 2,000 visitors per day. There were Muslims living and praying in 19th century Britain, of course, as documented, for example, by Joseph Salter, the so-called missionary to the Asiatics of Britain, in his 1870s account of his work in the 1850s and 60s. By the 1890s, there were working mosques in both Woking and Liverpool. But the wide circulation of Muller's painting provided a far larger number of people with the opportunity to encounter an image of Islamic religious devotion. This image offered an alternative to prevailing notions of Islam as warmongering, slave trading, convert seeking, and a contemporary imperial political threat. So this is the painting that Muller himself painted while when he got back from Egypt of the slave market, which is a really common theme. And he wrote at length about how much he'd enjoyed the visual spectacle of this market, which is kind of unpleasant to read about, really. So it wasn't an overwhelming theatrical spectacle. So just to return to prayer in the desert, this isn't, unlike many other Orientalist paintings of the time, an overwhelming theatrical spectacle with a cavalcade of exotic animals in tow, nor is it a sensationalist image of a harem or the slave market, which, as I said, Muller took great delight in observing and representing. It remains a British caricature of Islam, which wears its detailed authenticity claims heavily on its fancy dress sleeves. This is very much an East subject to British knowledge. But it's also testimony to a plurality of visual representations of Islam to accompany the diverse range of historical accounts of Islam in the 19th century that Humayun Ansari identified in a 2011 article exploring the Muslim world in British historical imaginations. So it provides a kind of, a visual counterpart and a visual alternative to these more sensationalist, I suppose more overtly Islamophobic images. Section two, Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery and the Civic Gospel. In 1885, Prayers in the Desert was donated to the newly opened BMAG and proudly exhibited in the purpose-built museum's central round room. Most reviews of the new gallery note the painting's presence, but the subject matter, again, does not seem to have been much of a matter of discussion among critics, nor is it noted as a particular crowd pleaser. It's just not really talked about at all. The real attraction, which you can see just down here, behind the barrier to the right of the image, was, much to the Magazine of Art's disgust, this image on the screen here. So the Magazine of Art called this the huge and entirely hideous painting by Willem Geats, the martyr of the 16th century. So this painting depicts the Lutheran woman Johanna de Santova being led out from a cathedral to be buried alive during the Inquisition in the Netherlands. close to this gruesome European image reveling in Catholic religious intolerance was, intriguingly, a portrait of Birmingham's own Cardinal John Henry Newman, painted by the celebrated local artist William Roden. Newman's portrait was joined by that of George Dawson, the nonconformist preacher and architect of Birmingham's civic gospel, to which I'll return. When it opened in 1885, the majority of the rest of the gallery displayed English landscapes by Birmingham-born painter David Cox. Visitors would have entered the room via John Bell's startling life-size sculpture of a nude black woman whose shackled hands, picked out in contrasting silver, leave us in no doubt as to her enslaved status. In Birmingham, this sculpture must surely have evoked and reaffirmed local nonconformist pride at Britain's abolitionist credentials. Indeed, a monument to Quaker abolitionist Joseph Sturge had been unveiled, accompanied by a speech from Dawson in the town in 1865. The sculpture itself, which you can just see here on the display stand, if you can see my mouse pointing, but it's just to the right of the display area here behind the chain. So the sculpture itself was manufactured by Elkington & Co., a local industrial art manufacturing company with a global success story. So the sculpture may also have served to make local connections with purportedly benevolent and successful industry. Although, as Caitlin Beach's forthcoming book, Sculpture at the Ends of Slavery, explores, Elkington was far from innocent from slavery, sourcing the silver, which works so effectively in this image to pick out the American slaves' chains. This silver was sourced from Cornish-run silver mines of the Real del Monte in Mexico. And the Black and Indigenous people working in these mines were either enslaved or coerced into this back-breaking toil. So even though there was this kind of local pride, there was another story to it as well. So just going back to the round room, by the mid-1890s, prayers in the desert had been joined by J.F. Lewis's Cairo marketplace scene, The Seraph, A Doubtful Coin, depicting two Muslim women asking a Jewish moneylender to judge some dubious currency, dramatising a cosmopolitan religious setting through genre painting and extremely dubious stereotypes. Judaism was further and rather unfavourably represented by William Holman Hunt's The Finding of the Saviour in the Temple, donated in 1896. And just as an aside, unlike Prayers in the Desert's redeeming features for today's Brummie Muslims, this painting was resoundingly rejected by the city's Jewish community representatives as a possible feature of the Contemporary Faith Gallery. Ford Madox Brown's vision of white settler migration, the last of England, added British imperial entitlement into the mix with these religions of religious and ethnic diversity. The core of the new museum in its first decade seems to have offered visitors a vision of Protestant victimhood and of radical nonconformist benevolence, both to the city and globally in its commemoration of the abolition of the slave trade, despite the ironies that it had been extremely involved in and benefited from the trade. It displayed the benefits of industry through the gains of which the gallery boasted, "We promote art." And it provided an acknowledgement of wider religious diversity, be that through grudging local civic pride in important figures like Newman, or more broadly in Prayers of the Desert, A Doubtful Coin, and The Finding of the Saviour in the Temple. This selection was arguably not just whatever the city could assemble, although histories of museums are of course riddled with contingencies. But these paintings were carefully selected and donated by prime movers in what was now Birmingham's famous civic gospel. Prayers in the Desert, for example, was donated to the museum by Joseph Chamberlain, the MP for Birmingham, regarded as the driving force behind the implementation of the civic gospel, And the painting had been on display in his house, Highbury Hall, in Birmingham before. So it was in his personal collection. While Geats's painting, The Martyr of the 16th Century, was a gift from Chamberlain's brother-in-law and fellow Unitarian, Alderman William Kenrick. The paintings displayed together in this central room might be read as a visual embodiment of the civic gospel. And this is significant for our purposes today, as it offers such a rich and complex vision of the relationship between art, religion, race, and civic institutions. The civic gospel remains one of Victorian Birmingham's most celebrated undertakings, lauded today in the city's own cultural institutions by politicians of various stripes, and still only rarely, although increasingly now, questioned by historians. Indeed, for a long time, adulatory visions of the civic gospel have been almost the only narrative of 19th century Birmingham voiced at all. The 18th century has James Watt and Matthew Boulton, and the 19th century has the civic gospel. It's usually kind of the things that get highlighted and picked out. And it's not my intention simply to reaffirm these stories, which, as Andy Green has so importantly argued, served to homogenise and make respectable a town which was anything but monocultural and well-behaved, marginalising a diverse range of 19th century Brummie experiences. Instead, I want to use the civic gospel to emphasise the imbrication of the religious and the secular in what is often regarded as one of the 19th century's most secular innovations, the museum. Briefly, the civic gospel posited a new interventionist form of municipal government, informed primarily by non-conformist beliefs about the responsibility of local government for the physical and moral health of its citizenry. Its origins and champions are usually traced to Unitarian ministers George Dawson and Henry Crosskey in the 1860s, and later Dawson's Congregationalist student Robert Dale. It was most famously put into practice by Joseph Chamberlain, a member of Crosskey's congregation, and a new generation of liberal nonconformist town councillors in the 1870s. During Chamberlain's period as mayor from 1873 to 6, gas and water were municipalised, and the profits used for new civic ventures, not least the construction of Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery, which you can see. So this is the appropriately enough, Chamberlain Memorial Fountain there. And we've got Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery here, which was built on top of the council offices, literally built on top of the water offices. And so you can see kind of the real connection, the physical connection between these places. The forerunner of BMAG, a one-room gallery in the town library, had opened in 1867 and had, since 1872, been opened on a Sunday, a result of 2 months of debate, in contrast to the 40 years of discussions that it took for the national institutions in London, apart from the Crystal Palace at Sydenham, to be opened on Sundays. So this apparently secularising move was also the result of the civic gospel's interweaving of local politics and religious interventionism. The idea was basically you'd go to the art gallery on a Sunday and it would elevate you morally. But as representations of racial and religious diversity appeared 7 days a week on the walls of the town museum, racial and religious diversity were increasingly extirpated from the town centre. The civic gospel might have insisted that access to art would morally and aesthetically improve its populace. But in the late 1870s, it also demolished swathes of town centre slums or working class districts, depending on one's perspective, to build new commercial and civic spaces, principally Corporation Street and the Law Courts. And so Corporation Street is visible. It's this big kind of wide open road. It's visible here, photograph here. And then the other image is kind of what it looked like before. So it was in these districts that were demolished that the majority of the town's Irish Catholic population resided, as well as its three boarding houses for Indian men. The sense that these were areas riddled with criminality and danger had already been compounded by the response to the 1867 Murphy riots, when the visit of anti-Catholic preacher William Murphy triggered 3 days of rioting, for which, despite the violence largely being enacted against them, the local Irish Catholic population was held responsible. This violence was directed not just at local Catholics. On the second day of rioting, the Protestants also turned on the town synagogue. Geats's intensely popular Protestant martyr takes on new and peculiar valences in these contexts. So to kind of draw this all to a conclusion. BMAG's Faith Gallery reconceptualizes prayers in the desert in a religious context, in a city characterized by religious diversity. But this painting and the paintings that surrounded it in 1880s Birmingham throw up all sorts of questions about religious diversity and the religious secular divide. Reading these paintings in relation to each other and in relation to the civic gospel demonstrates how these visually arresting works contributed to and shaped a perhaps unexpected and unexpectedly imbricated web of religious and secular contexts. They orchestrate new conversations and bring new characters into histories of art. Prayers in the desert brought European landscape traditions to bear on Muslim religious practice, put 17th century landscape painter Claude into conversation with Edward Lane's 19th century musings on the manners and customs of the Egyptians, and also with London's 1840s Black and South Asian population. In 1880s Birmingham, it drew connections between Chamberlain's civic gospel and the populations of the town made homeless by that gospel. Its painterly vision of the quote unquote earnest devotion of Muslims at prayer situated it between the religious and secular, like the civic gospel which brought it to 1880s Birmingham. BMAG is at the moment closed, and under the new directorship of joint CEOs Zach Mensah and Sarah Wajid since November 2020, Birmingham Museums Trust is seeking, and this is a quotation, to promote anti-racism and human rights by addressing the history of structural inequalities embedded in our collections, our buildings, and our structures. The research I've presented today provides some information about the historical foundations of the collections and the ways in which race, religion, and difference have long been threaded through and into the museum's histories. Given the rather extreme responses to the National Trust's scholarly exploration of its properties' colonial histories and connections with slavery, it seems likely that reactionary critics will accuse Mensah and Wajid of being ahistorical or imposing a so-called woke agenda on historical collections. But what I've shown today is that racial and religious diversity have been part of the museum's displays from its inception. And there is certainly much more to explore when it comes to unpicking the colonial exploitation that underpinned the collecting and finances of the museum in the 1880s. And I think it's really exciting that the institution has directors who want to explore this and want to put this on display to Birmingham's populace. When the museum fully reopens in 2024, it will have entirely new displays. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what new stories will be told around prayers in the desert. So, thank you.
Thank you, Kate, for a fantastic paper. I mean, I really enjoyed that. I thought it was incredibly rich conceptually and also visually really arresting. So thank you. That was brilliant. As I say, we do have time now for some questions. So if you would like to ask a question, please, as I say, you can either raise your hand or you can type the word question into chat. To start things off, Kate, if I can just ask a just boring biographical question, thinking about that Müller painting, which I didn't know before. How significant, I suppose the two things I'd ask, one is how significant is it that he has German ancestry? Like, I don't know to what extent he was culturally German in any sense. But, you know, if we're thinking about histories of Orientalism and interest in Islam, German scholarship obviously is very important in that field. And, you know, I'm thinking about Suzanne Marchand and other people who've worked on that. So I just wonder whether we know anything about the sort of German horizons of Muller himself. And the other thing I wondered is that, am I right in thinking he's a Unitarian? Because I suppose, is there a question, is there something interesting going on about admiration for Islam within certain versions of Protestantism, and particularly the idea that Islam is a more rational kind of faith? You know, I'm thinking back to Gibbon in the 18th century with all of this admiration for Islam as a more kind of, you know, as an anti-papist sort of rational form of religion. So I just wondered if we know anything about Muller's own faith and how you see this as part of a bigger kind of Islamophilia, I suppose, within certain versions of kind of English intellectual culture.
I have to admit that I don't know anything about Muller's biography. He was born in Bristol and Bristol Museum's got loads of his work as a result of that, but I don't know anything about him or his faith. I really didn't look at it at all. But I would like to, you've raised such important questions that I would really like to find out more about it. I don't know about Islamophilia with his work, because he was so interested in the slave market as well. I'm not sure, but I think it's definitely something to kind of pick through. I guess my focus has been much more on kind of the reception of the image, but I need to know more about Muller. You're absolutely right. Does anybody know if he was a Unitarian? It'd be interesting.
There is a nod coming from David Feldman, in which case, David, do you want to unmute yourself and illuminate us?
Well, that great scholar, Mr. Wikipedia, tells us that he was at least buried in a Unitarian cemetery. But in a way, that what I wanted to ask or suggest leads off from Tom's question in a way, which is that I think what you did was really rich and stimulating, Kate. So this is sort of I'm a sort of not only but also question, and the but also is about whether there's a specifically theological reading of the painting which might have a particular significance in Birmingham. So what I have in mind is the sort of slow emergence in the 1840s when the painting was made of what we'd now call comparative theology. So there's Carlyle's chapter on Muhammad in 1840 in Heroes and Hero Worship, and then Morris writes about Islam in the book in 1847, the title in his book on the religions of the world. And it seems to me that there might be a connection between what they find in Islam, which is a religion, what they admire is the insistence on the unity of God, and what they don't like the idea that it's spread by the sword. And they find it underdeveloped because it's about obedience. And in that sense, their image of Islam is like their image of Judaism. But if one take, and it seems to me that the difference between Muller's painting and the more sort of more sensual versions of Orientalism that you showed sort of indicate perhaps a connection to that view of Islam, and one might speculate whether the emphasis, the idea that Islam has a particular its contribution is its insistence on the unity of God, might be why Unitarians were drawn to a particularly positive evaluation of it.
I think kind of looking into the kind of comparative theological aspects would be really interesting, actually, to kind of to give a bit of a, as I've focused so much on its kind of art world context, and it's really useful to hear the kind of more broad theological context for it. I think looking more into Unitarians and more into Muller as a Unitarian would be interesting, and the broader things we can take from that, right? What it means for Unitarians to be creating these positive images of Islam, and perhaps painting is somewhere that you wouldn't necessarily think to look. And I guess the interesting thing about painting is it gets moved around and put into conversations with different paintings, but it also goes in a book and kind of is a print that's in the home, so you can kind of engage with it on all these different levels too. So even if you're not kind of doing some serious theological reading, you might be able to encounter this image and it kind of give you some of those similar thoughts. There's a lot more homework I need to do, I think.
At which point can we bring in somebody who has their hand raised? Stina is just what's coming up on the as participants, and I don't know your full name, sorry, but if you want to unmute yourself, please ask your question.
All right, I think I'm unmuted, am I?
We can hear you.
Okay. I'm Stina Lyon. I'm a sociologist and a philosopher by training, now retired emeritus. I just want to thank you for your wonderful paper, because it was raised many interesting questions, but it also illustrates the difficulties of making cultural histories, because there is a theme of this period that you don't really mention and that arose from the Enlightenment, and that is individualism. That one can read the painting not just as a picture of a race or a religion or with a perspective of such, but also they are quite extraordinarily a group of individuals with individual faces, and as such they have individual souls. And if you look at Millet's painting, St. Angelus, which is about these working class people, potato pickers, wherever they are in the field, who stop because of the St. Angelus bell, and they are pictured as laborers, but they have souls and as individuals, not as a kind of mass or a threatening mass. And I would like you to have a little thought about that, because I think it underlies some of what then became the attempts at anti-slavery and the whole lost, is that these are actually real individuals with souls, just like the people who are kind of writing about them. Then if there are collected or constructed as armchair anthropologists, becomes a kind of secondary to the fact that they are actually individuals with souls in prayer, in devotion, and they could be any religion. We just share that as a common sentiment as individuals, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think to a certain extent, people kind of got that from the painting at the time. I think that kind of, you know, the fact that comments weren't sort of, you know, sensationalist at all about it. People just said, oh, look, you know, this is kind of earnest. They talked a lot about the earnest devotion of the people at prayer, and this idea of seeing some kind of commonality, even if, you know, the costumes are very different and the people doing it are very different. There's still this sense that there is worship is happening here, and it's could be received and understood in a particular way. But I think it's really good to kind of go back to thinking about them as individual people. And I think also it's strange because, you know, it doesn't show unified prayer, but see those individual characters.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was really struck, Kate, in the almost the seriality of it. I mean, echoing what Stina's just said, that the different poses, you know, the rhythm of the bodies, it does feel like it's many distinct moments in that way. It's sort of interesting, the compression of prayer into these different states, kind of all in one image. Does that map onto, you know, you showed the lane diagram. Are they distinct? I mean, does it map quite closely onto what Lane's talking about in terms of modes of prayer? I just wondered what the gestures sort of relate to.
It fits completely onto like kind of the stages of prayer that Lane talks about. And the image, I mean, I can show quickly if it's useful, because I perhaps whizzed through that a little bit. There it is. So yeah, you can see, I mean, this figure. Can you actually see my mouse on the screen?
We can.
Oh, good. Okay, because I was thinking just wildly saying this figure here, and everyone's like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. This figure here is obviously this figure here. So you can really see that he's kind of translated various sort of what Lane has identified as the particular stages of prayer. I'll stop sharing the screen.
I just think there's something really interesting about the seriality of it, I suppose, that the complete prayer is only read across multiple bodies, and sort of it's one gesture but divided between six persons. At which point I saw there was a question thinking about individuality. I think it's Michael Robertson in the chat has a question. Michael, do you want to unmute yourself and ask your question?
That's fine if you want to just read it yourself, that would be just fine.
Okay, Michael. Kate, you might be able to see this, so I don't know if everyone else can, but Michael says, thanks for an excellent, intellectually rich talk. One of the threads you didn't have time to explore was the gendered nature of the painting which you showed, which fits in with other later depictions of Islamic prayer as communal and male, as opposed to prayer showing individual women and children. Could you say more about the gendered division?
Well, I would like to. I don't know much about images of Christian women at prayer, but it's really, really, you very rarely see. And I just, let me have a moment to think about it. I mean, I guess it kind of keys into that 19th century, mid to late 19th century fascination with religious women, and with kind of a sort of slightly sensationalist interest in kind of the rise of convents and stuff as well. So I would imagine it keys into that, the reason that it's often Christian women shown at prayer, shown as something, I suppose, that you educate children into doing, and perhaps a suspicion of images of men praying. Although you have all of the Simeon Solomon images of men, solitary men at prayer, from all different faiths as well, which would be a great topic for another one of these discussions, actually. And his whole series of images of men from all different religions praying, isolated images of men. But, you know, Simeon Solomon is such an outlier in 19th century art in so many ways, and his images were seen as really quite strange. But they do show devotional images of men kind of lost in their own spiritual devotion, very sensual images of men. So I'm just kind of rambling now, but I think it would be a great thing to kind of explore in more detail.
That's wonderful. Can I ask, Daniel Burrell is on the call as well. Hello, Daniel. Do you want to unmute and ask a question?
Hi there. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the talk as well. It's very interesting. I also wanted to ask about sort of the gender balance, but I think we've kind of discussed that sort of the masculine sort of dominance in those sort of depictions of prayer. But I do have a second part which I wouldn't mind asking, and that's really thinking about, well, how do we think about sort of the art gallery or the state museum in this era within the context of kind of an evolving British religiosity? I mean, you talked about sort of the opening up of these kind of civic institutions on Sundays, and the role of these institutions to kind of morally uplift society, and I was just curious about, could we think about these institutions as kind of a new church for a new imperialism or a new society almost? Not necessarily taking the role of the church, but kind of taking some of its old responsibilities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think someone like Amy Woodson Bolton has written really amazing work on this. Her book Transformative Beauty is about art museums in industrial towns in Britain. And I think there's often that thing, oh, the museum is the new church. You know, museum is, but the museum is an avowedly secular place. And more recently, you know, lots of museologists are kind of writing about museums as non-secular spaces now, but thinking back to that idea and seeing them as places that were profoundly engaged in questions about faith. I mean, especially in a city like Birmingham, well, town as it was, like Birmingham, where it was so much bound up in the civic gospel, which is this kind of odd, you know, it's a religious movement as well. So it's, I think it's, you can't really disentangle them. And I think kind of thinking about museums through religious culture is kind of would be a really interesting project. And I know someone like Lucy Matthews-Jones has worked on this as well. There's not been that much done, really.
That makes sense. Thank you. Just as a second part of that, I was just curious about then kind of the agency of these types of museums, to what extent they are kind of instigating a kind of religious pluralism, or not so much a tolerance, but a kind of, in what way they are affecting themselves, kind of evolutions within British religiosity, or to what extent they are simply a symptom or a reflection of it.
That's a big question. Let's have a think. I mean, I said I'm a key believer in the importance of museums. So maybe I can argue from my perspective that they're really, you know, transformative. They're places of mass access. 2,000 people a day going into Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery in its first few years. That's incredible. That's a huge number of people to be visiting a museum. You know, it's really quite small at that point as well. So they're definitely places that are used. Not sure. I mean, I'm not a historian of religion, but it would be a great question to kind of think more about.
That's fine. Thank you.
If I can piggyback on Daniel for a sec, Kate, before I turn to another question, have you found much about the response to these pictures amongst, because you said obviously the critics aren't saying much about it, but it might be these pictures or others. I was just interested in, like, to what extent is devotion or sort of moral and religious reflection something that you're finding amongst the records of museum goers? I know these sources are hard to come by, but I was really provoked by what you were saying about trying to put religion back into the museum. And, you know, I think you can clearly see it in terms of some of the donors and the founders, but I wonder whether you've actually found any evidence of that amongst museum visitors as well, that this is a place where they're going for spiritual uplift, and what that might tell us about how aesthetic response, I don't know, is inflected with something religious.
It's not something I've done with BMAG yet, but it's something that I know, you know, it's very hard to capture, even now, to capture visitor museum experience. And even when you fill in a form, I'm not, you know, kind of visitor feedback form, I'm not sure whether that really captures much about what might be a spiritual experience. But it's something I need to look at. You know, I say this is quite early days with this project, so I'm just scribbling everything down frantically. You'll all have to be thanked when it turns into a book.
It's the mark of a great project that it raises all these questions. Now I'm going to ask Claire Stainthorpe to come in, actually, just to articulate something that a couple of people have raised in chat, and I think is, you know, might go to the heart of both the question about gender and also religious practice. Claire, do you want to unmute?
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for this paper, Kate. It's so interesting. I'm really interested in sort of civic Birmingham, and it's a completely different angle from whatever I thought about before. So thank you. It was definitely an observation rather than a question, but was around the separation of Islamic prayer spaces, often into sort of male and female spaces, and whether the fact that I think all the images you showed, and obviously so much of Victorian sort of large grand scale, grand paintings at scale were by male painters, and so actually what they would have been able to observe would not have been the sort of private sort of female spaces of prayer, but the masculine more public spaces which they would have been privy to. And Zara, I think that's how you pronounce her name, has sort of also suggested a similar thing, but I think she's currently in the library and so can't pop on to comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting actually, because there are a few British and French Orientalist painters who travel to who travel in Ottoman Turkey, who are women, and they do go and meet lots of Ottoman women, especially wealthy women who want to commission portraits from them. so these artists actually do get to kind of go into the household and see private spaces. They never depict religious scenes. So that even people who have the chance don't seem to want to be kind of, or to, I mean, but actually they're, I mean, they're people who are commissioned to paint portraits, and, you know, the women who've commissioned their portraits from them are powerful and don't want, and want to be represented in a particular way. It's much more about showing them in kind of modern French fashion. So, but yeah, I think it's really important to think more about kind of who gets represented at prayer, and who it's interesting to see represented at prayer. Maybe all of those Unitarians didn't necessarily want to see, weren't interested in seeing Muslim women at prayer. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely an important thing to think a bit more about those gendered dimensions. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Picking up on the point about prayer, Kate, there's a question here from Ella, who cannot ask it herself because she's traveling, but picking up on what David and Sheena were saying about one God and individual prayer, Ella was struck by the fact that the image is quite redolent of scenes of the nativity, you know, three kings, shepherds, in terms of composition. She thinks about the way that they're focusing, looking towards the east. There's an unseen object of devotion. She wondered whether there was something non-specific about the painting as well as specific. You know, are there other kind of iconographies that it riffs off somehow?
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, I can't hear your lovely voice. Sorry, I do know Ella, that's not just me being rude. I just realised. I've looked at that painting so many times and that has never occurred to me. I now need to look at it again. But you're right. Yeah, I can see what you mean in that kind of generalized sort of an Eastern scene in the desert. So you're kind of looking at some alternative iconographic traditions that it might be drawing on, as well as the very obvious. I think maybe I've been a bit limited by looking at Lane, because Lane is so obviously what it draws on, but there's many other visual compositional things that it draws on too. Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it.
Can I ask a historical question, Kate, which I suppose was related to that? I was quite interested that you were suggesting that by the end of the 19th century, this interest in pluralism has actually been inscribed onto the walls of the museum. You know, that there is an interest in bringing these kind of moments in religious practice or moments in religious history in conversation. When would you say that starts to happen? Because it's interesting that there's sort of multiple historical moments in your paper. There's the moment of Muller producing the painting and then exhibiting it, and then there's the kind of attempt to try and create a kind of comparative framework for it or a context for it. And I just, when is it, do you think, that the kind of the vision of the figures behind the museum is to try and create this sort of religious conversation?
I wouldn't say it's so much. I mean, I'm also a big believer in museums as being completely accidental things in many ways, that there isn't, even if there might be kind of an overarching plan, quite often that, you know, kind of things come about in unexpected ways. But I do think that, I think regardless of the people who are kind of in charge, it's very much dependent on rich donors giving paintings. And so it's almost like the Chamberlains and their circle were able to give this stuff to the museum, and because it's come from the Chamberlain, you have to stick it in the round room because they're important. And so whether it's necessarily intentional, I'm not really sure, but it's something created by those particular non-conformist communities in the city who have risen to these kind of positions. So, I mean, I guess it can't happen before 1885, because there isn't a museum before 1885 in the same way. There's a museum, you know, some paintings up in and some sculptures up in a library, but it's not the same as kind of going explicitly to an art gallery set up to be looked at. So I don't really have an answer, but I don't think it's sort of a matter of someone sitting down and saying, we're opening a museum, it's going to be like this, we're going to kind of put this message across. I think it's much more people are giving this, and it's kind of created by the town in a way, by the people who have wealth and influence within the town. and people are kind of competing to do this as well.
I have to ask, partly because we're thinking about things being given, if you look ahead into the 20th century, how many of these pictures remain on display? I mean, have some of these things had to be dug back out of the reserve because they fell out of favour, or have these things been part of the round room throughout the 20th century?
Prayers in the Desert was through the whole 20th century. And then it was removed and put in the Faith Gallery in 2014. But now things are going to be very different, which is really exciting. And I wonder, I'm not quite sure how it's going to be displayed in the future. I don't know what will happen to the Faith Gallery, which is really, it's very unusual to have such a thing. So it's quite intriguing that there is one in Birmingham. But yeah, a lot of these, the portraits aren't on show. The Pre-Raphaelite painting, the Holman Hunt is in the Pre-Raphaelite Gallery, so that gets its own special space, because I suppose they also, the museum gets much bigger in the early 20th century. But some of these works, so these are all given by donors, but then there's also the Public Picture Fund, who buy works to give to the museum, and they kind of have much more information about, you know, what is the right kind of work to buy for the city, and anything that comes from them has to stay on display. Otherwise, they will take stuff back. Similarly, if a charge is ever imposed on the museum, everything is given on the condition of the museum access being free, and there's still quite a strong hold on the museum. I mean, they're an incredible, you know, they're still buying works for the museum. Even now, they were founded in the 19th century and they're still, you know, it's still an ongoing thing. But it, I think the works, things do go on and off display, but there's kind of a core of stuff in the round room that doesn't change that much. But some of the stuff is, you know, the doubtful coin is not on display, for example. I don't think the portraits of Newman are, but it's been a long time because the museum has been closed since lockdown. But the Geats, the huge and entirely hideous, I sort of inclined to agree, is still on display in the round room.
As the display gets refreshed, you were talking about sort of community curators, as it were, and you know the advice that from Muslim curators and so on. Will those community interpretations be included with the paintings going forward? I mean, do you have a sense that they want to bring those voices into the museum?
Definitely. I don't know how it's going to work, but I know that I think it's going to be really quite different and quite exciting. So I think once you can, you know, so they're reopening part of the gallery. So the original 19th century core of the gallery, actually the round room in the industrial gallery, which comes off it, is reopening for the Commonwealth Games. In 2022, but then the whole museum will be reopened in January 2024. So there's a while to work on what's going to be displayed, how and where, and it will be interesting to see, you know, the shifts. And you know, it's always been a very political art gallery, and I think it's really exciting that it's actively engaging now as well.
We have just a few more minutes before we finish. If anybody else wants to jump in with a question, please pop one in the chat or raise your hand. If not, I was going to, as a final thing, Kate, I suppose, actually someone has popped something in. Claire has put in.
Yeah, not a question, just an observation and a link to sort of thinking about religion in that space of that round reading room, for those who don't know it as a contemporary space. That was all it was. Again, Kate might be able to, I don't know, talk to it. But
yeah, you can't, I don't know why, I mean, it's an unmissable sculpture. Lucifer is now in the centre. I don't know when he arrived, but they can't move him because he's so big. But yeah, that kind of subverts quite a lot, actually. It has long been a meeting place for young Goths of Birmingham as well, the Lucifer statue, which is rather nice. So I see the museum being used by so many different groups, and that like the Lucifer statue has long been a meeting place for Birmingham's Goths.
Local knowledge there. I just the last thing I wanted, just a question of ignorance, because you talked about the Lascar community. I thought really interestingly about what sort of religious diversity there was within mid-19th century Birmingham. And as you say, when I think about the first mosques in Victorian England, I often think, is it 1870, Woking and Liverpool? It's around that sort of time. Do we know much about Muslim communities in Victorian Britain before the arrival of these, you know, religious institutions? I wondered if we know anything about religious practice, because you talked about there being missionary efforts being made. And I just wonder what those sources tell us about Muslim communities in mid-Victorian England.
So there's Joseph Salter's book from the 1870s, and that recounts his 1850s and 60s missions to the Asiatics, as he puts it. And to be honest, it tells you something, but it doesn't tell you much. I mean, it tells you more about what Joseph Salter thinks, which is interesting, but it perhaps doesn't reveal what you might want to know. But he kind of notes where all of the, so there are boarding houses for Indian men, like he kind of refers to them as Indian men, in many big cities in the UK. Some of those people will have been practicing Muslims. And he goes around, he describes going to someone's, to some of these boarding houses and going into people's homes and watching people pray. So there's his book, and I don't know how popular that was, but it's, I mean, it was certainly available, and that kind of knowledge. But yeah, it's interesting. So I think, yeah, it's, there were three boarding houses for what Salter called Indian men in that bit that got demolished, which was mostly Irish Catholics living there at the time as well. So again, you kind of see this sort of, yeah, changing demographics, I guess.
Which would be a fantastic thing to plot, as you say, as you're looking at the evolution of the gallery, to kind of put that in dialogue with the changing, you know, immigrant audiences within Birmingham. I think it's a totally fascinating project. Okay, we are out of time. So at which point I'm going to wrap up. I'm going to say a huge thank you to Kate for giving us such a stimulating paper and kind of collecting and fielding those questions so brilliantly. Thank you all for your questions to her. I'm delighted to say that we are going to be back in the new year, and our next session will be a paper from Fionnuala Sweeney from the English department in Newcastle. Fionnuala is a specialist in American and Black Atlantic literature, and she's published widely on race, slavery and empire, and on figures like Frederick Douglass. So we hope to see many of you there. But Kate, thank you so much again for a great paper, and good night, everyone. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all your brilliant questions, everyone. It's been really helpful.